I'd like to start asking you a few questions, if I could, Don, about your father. Not long ago, we found out that your father was actually put Project Sign together and started Project Sign. First, what I would like to ask you is if you could describe your father, what he was like as a father, what he looked like, what he enjoyed doing.
Well, that's a tough question. He was a 110% German, and because I carry those genes too, his father came over from Hanover, Germany. We traced him back that way. So he was had a mind of his own. You might say he could have been stubborn, but he's a very dedicated man. As from a religious point of view, we're all raised Catholics, and he was too, of course. And so he had this mindset that he was a workaholic. He worked very hard trying to do what he thought was best. He was not a politician. As the expression go, he would be the first one to piss off the Pope in for a conversation. And he just said what he wanted, and he had a very narrow lip, and so his smile wouldn't often see it. He was very dedicated to his work, and he always talked about aviation and aeronautical things. He had a few close friends, not many. He was an automobile freak. He always loved the big Buicks, the big cars. And he always, in his spare time, was working on them, changing spark plugs and changing oil and doing anything, mechanical things.
Do you remember any of your father's friends' names?
Yeah, there was a fellow by the name of Murray who lived in Dayton, Ohio, who lived just kind of behind this house that our folks rented.
Did he work at...
No, I forget whether Mr. Murray worked in the right pad or not. But they would just joke along with each other, and they were the first ones that have a TV set. We'd go over and watch Black and White flash away in the darkened room. There was another one, again, his name now, but they were kind of friends too. I think it was, I'm going to say Johnson, but I might be off on that. But he had just a handful of friends, and I spent some limited times with them.
What did he do with his friends? Did they travel together?
Well, I think the Murrays, they came out here in 1948 and went over to Pikes Peak. He just bought a brand new 48 Plymouth and made a trip out west for a couple of weeks. But that was about the only trip I remember with his friends, if I recall. He didn't really take vacations. And the only time we got together as a family was once in a while, Friday night for dinner. Which was a fish dinner in those days. Then Sunday afternoons was the family drive, which my brother and I would usually end up being handsome back to the car waiting for my dad to get ready, and so he'd end up swacking us in the backseat as we drove along, and usually family drive ended up with a big family argument. But we'd go to church Sunday morning, and then in the afternoon we'd have the famous family drive. And
it was a big Buick.
Yeah, it was a big car, big Buick, and of course when he left the Wright Pat and got the job with Unexcel Chemical Corporation, he got himself a nice big 1951 Cadillac. It was a baby blue.
Where did you go on your Sunday drive?
Well, just driving in the areas in Dayton, Ohio, not too far away. It'd be about an hour job drive.
So on Sundays was about the only time you really got to interact with your dad?
Yeah, and that was family time. Once in a while, it would be a Friday evening dinner, some restaurant, a fish dinner, and then we'd go over to the Murray's house. And I'm trying to remember the other man's name, but we didn't see them as often as I think Murray was probably his best friend. He would talk once in a while about his work, but not too often. And... he was always, we always seemed to have a basement someplace in the homes, and he was always down there working on aircraft drawings, his inventions, and then when he started making these solid propellants, he was always pounding solid rockets down in the basement.
Did you ever have any fear maybe something might blow up?
Well, my mother was always concerned about that. And I used to go down and see him pound his rockets and then sign what black powder was. And I used to steal some of that. And I used to have these little metal airplanes, you know, flare crafts. And one time I went in and got my little airplane with like a Corsair. And I got some of this black powder and put it in a little paper bag underneath the wing and then lit a fuse. And unfortunately, the fuse was faster than I was, and it blew up in my face. So I was all blackened from my black powder.
What'd your dad do?
He didn't know about it.
Oh.
He didn't know I stole some of his black powder. But the fumes, he always had the fumes down the basement of working with testers, cement. He's always building model airplanes. And then plus working black powder, and I think this was the cause of his cancer later on.
Oh, really?
And all those toxic fumes. And but he was a workaholic. He worked at in the basement, and noise on his drawings, and that was all his time. And when he spent time with me, we'd be talking about hydrals of effect of wings and so forth, and some very technical stuff. And I, like a good son, tried to stay awake. And but it was very few times that he really would be like a good buddy. And a couple of times, being active in the scouts, he would come to some of the meetings where I would give a discussion about making plaster cast of animals in front of the scout group and the parents. And he would come to a couple of those meetings. And I did drag him out to a couple of camp outings where we did some hikes. And he really suffered in those things. He was not an out-of-doors man. And so, you know, sleeping in a tent and then eating some overcooked fried eggs in the morning or whatever. So I've got some old pictures of him with a handkerchief around his forehead, sweating away on a little hike. But I think he went out about two camp meetings with me.
And that was enough for
him? Yeah, that was it. And then he'd take me out to these model aircraft meets. He'd have those on Sunday where he'd fly his rocket-propelled airplanes when it was a kind of a sweat-wing deal. And everybody would order that as to take off the solid propellants and he made solid rockets. And then he told me back in those days, that first winter I flew was back in 1938. But when I was, I guess, in grade school, he'd bring me some of these model airplane meets. And people would be flying gasoline-powered motors, and he'd have his rocket engines out there. But he was always told me that the problem with solid propellants, they would get cracks and voids in them, and they'd cause explosions. And later on, when they got into the space age rockets, he said that was a problem with the solid propellants. And that's where they switched to liquids, because they avoided the problem with detonations.
Real tough question here. But I need to ask it. You say your father was a workaholic. Didn't really spend all that much time with him. How did you and Jim feel about that?
Well, we had our outside friends. It was a splintered family deal. He and my dad never got along too well together. And it was always...
Can you give me a reason?
Well, I guess they had a different opinion. Jim finally went to West Point, got appointed to West Point, and and he was very glad to leave home because he and Dad didn't get along that well together. And I guess I was his favorite, but he never did spend that much time with me because I missed that father contact at times. But he was always had his projects, whether it was working in the basement and aircraft drawings and aeronautical nature of things, or he was working on this car. And I get to hate the word projects, because if I wanted to go play someplace and people are going to help on a project, and then I was quarantined until I did some little work like that.
So you actually went into the basement, into his workshops?
Oh yeah, I was down there a lot with him and at the time, but he was very busy and he would talk, very technical talk with me at times. A lot of times he'd be working on his cars and vehicles and so forth. But he always had, he was always busy within himself and never had that much time for family. Of course, my brother and I, in grade school, we took piano lessons as we hammer out practice and piano at times. And my mother worked always in either banks
and parts.
Marion. And she was a very good tennis player, and she gave it up after she left college. And I said, well, she should have kept it up, and that would have made her live longer, I think. But I've done the same thing. I played a lot of tennis, and I gave it up 8 years ago. I just got burned out of being a tennis bum. But we do change as we get older. But as far as getting back to Dad, he was just, he wasn't an easy person to get to know, and our vacations would be, you asked about travel, we'd go to see his mother in Ambridge, Pennsylvania, and sometimes they'd drop us off there, my brother and I, for about 6 or 8 weeks, and we hated that because we had our cousins to play with, but the farm, we called it, was just a big old family home where Dad was raised. In Ambridge, Pennsylvania. And it was just some acreage, a lot of woods and all. It's not really a farm, but we call it the farm. And it was down on a hollow, and we used to have to walk over to see our cousins and walk through the cemeteries nearby, and that was our fun for the whole summer. So it was, every time Dad wanted to go someplace, he wanted to visit his mother, which didn't go along too well with my mother, because his mother, my mother, didn't get along too well together. She was a German matriarch, and of course, her husband died when he was about 45 years old. He was a builder in Ambridge, and he died from ruptured appendix. But the German attitude then, you know, you can't be sick, and if you're sick, you're a sissy. So he never did go see the doctor, so he died at the age of 45. But then his wife, my grandmother, Dad's mother, and took over the family, raised 7 children with an iron hand. And you could see the fear of God in their eyes any time we got together. Because no one stepped out of line from Frieda Lodi, because she'd give me the old, her snooping real fast. But the family meetings there in Ambridge, when we were there, the family would stay together, and they'd get together and they'd sing, and one would play the piano. My dad used to play the drums. And so it would be a musical get-together, all the cousins and uncles and aunts and so forth. And then they would always have what they call the lunch at midnight. One of the unlucky hosts, one of the brothers would have the group over, and he had to provide a big spread on the dining room table with lunch meat mostly. And if it wasn't enough, you'd then hear from the other brothers and sisters.
Sounds like the family I belong
yeah,
to.
Yeah, right.
Whenever you put the food out, everybody shows up.
So that was the extent of the family type vacations, with visiting maybe old homestead and visiting his mother.
We know your father traveled an awful lot on business. And that, were there any times at all that you can remember that you accompanied him on a business trip?
No, all the business trips were the government, and they were just by himself or with some other people from Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Did travel quite a bit, though.
I would like to mention some names, and if you have any recollection, tell me about those. And if not, that's okay. Have you ever heard of, at the time, not recently, but at the time, Colonel Howard McCoy?
Yeah, I remember the name McCoy.
Did he ever come over to the house in your
recollection? No.
How about Albert Jarmet?
No. Never mentioned that. He did mention at times of some colonels he worked for, and he was very unhappy with the way they handled their end of the business.
Did he tell you exactly what was going on that was causing his unhappiness?
He was a civilian, and he always thought the military people were incompetent as far as being professional aeronautical engineers and the work that he was doing and trying to get done. As I said, he was a very dedicated man, and he believed in what he was doing. And if anybody else differed with him, they were wrong. Of course, I see that viewpoint myself.
Well, your father was a genius when it came to low aspect ratio aircraft and all kinds of other things. And I can understand why he would probably think that military engineers probably just couldn't keep up with him, because he was obviously a very forward-thinking thinking man, as far as designs and things like this. Is this kind of what?
Well, he thought the military people were not really. I don't know their backgrounds, but I doubted whether they're professional aeronautical engineers or physicists and so forth. You know, Einstein had his run-ins with people too. He was the same way. And people didn't get along with Einstein either because he had his way of thinking of things. And Dad's, he studied what other people were doing, like apparently in his patents about Horton, German design, but he was up to date in what other countries were doing as far as at the edge of aeronautical designs. He helped Blank Aircraft, and he was the chief stress analysis, and he helped them put together a better aircraft. As a matter of fact, one of the Blanca sons called me back about 1990, rang me down, and he said his dad spoke glowingly about my dad's work with him.
Do you remember the name?
I forget his first name, but there was a Blanca family, and I think they might have done some aircraft work up in Michigan at that time. It's about 1990. I think Dad worked at Blanca about 1938 or so. It was Delaware. But just like when Dad started using the solid propellants in his model airplanes, that was such a breakthrough. Everybody else was using these gasoline engines. And so he was doing something. He was, at that time, maybe 20 years ahead of his time. He was
did he ever mention the Horton brothers to you?
No.
Down in the workshop or anything?
No. As I said, he rarely mentioned anything about work. I remember when Colonel, or Major Sweet it was one of his friends in the military, and he was a glider pilot. And one of these aircraft meets, I tried to run down Colonel Sweet to see, or Major Sweet to see if he was still alive, if he remembered anything about my dad's work. But they were, that was probably his closest friend in the military, his friendly one. And Major Sweet took me up in the glider. They had a glider contest one time. And they stabbed me in the back seat of this glider, and they pulled us off. And all of a sudden, we started doing spins and throw out a roll of toilet paper. And I thought, what are you usually doing? I was maybe 12 years old at the time. They throws out a roll of toilet paper out the cockpit, and they make two tight turns and cuts the toilet paper twice at the wingtip, and the interval of time shows whether you win or lose as you're standing with the other glider pilots.
Wow, I've never heard that.
Yeah, and seeing that toilet paper roll out, and all you saw the horizon and the ground all get mixed up together as you went in a tight spin. And then they had a dive bomb. This is all on a glider, and dropped some flour within the target. And then another event was to land in the shortest period of time. But if you've ever been in a glider, you're sitting on a board, and then there's a skid in the nose, and there's a small wheel underneath this board you're sitting on. And they fly onto the runway, and they have this wires or string pulled up, and as soon as you pass that, you're supposed to drop and land at the shortest distance. But they put the spoilers up, which would kill the airflow in the wings, and you drop like a rock. Meanwhile, your rear end is on this board, which is right next to the ground. And it was quite a shock to have your rear end bounce up by your head, and all of a sudden you landed in a short period of time, and your eyeballs are bulging out. And of course, when you started, they put me in this back seat with a parachute, because they said, here's this ring to pull, and how to get out in case the wing came off. Well, at that time, I wanted to get out of the aircraft. This is the first time I've been in a glider or a sailplane, and it was all high-performance stuff and in the contest. So I didn't drop my cookies, but I don't know why. But I hung on, and then after we stopped, they came to help me out, and I couldn't get out of the aircraft. I was wedged in with the parachute. So I thought to myself, see, what if the wing came off? I had to jump out like in the movies. I had no way I would have still sat in the airplane. So, but that was his Major Sweet. I remember we went to quite a few glider meets, and that was one of the few times when I've been.
Did you ever personally make models yourself?
Yeah, I made my airplanes, and of course, since Dad was doing it, and he was always inspecting my inferior work, and but I did do quite a few of balsa wood airplanes. That was a thing to do in those days. time when you're a teenager in grade school.
Your father has a picture, a photograph of himself with what appears to be a flying saucer model. Mm-hmm. Can you tell me something about that?
Well, he did all this. He would tell me about all these investigations of, starting about 47 on UFOs. And it was a year after he started the investigation, which was about July 1947. And I think about 1948, he wrote this patent. And he made these model airplanes of one is a photograph you saw with the wings on it, and a large body, oval-shaped body with wings on it. Then he refined it, took the wings off, and just made stabilizers on the back end of it. And he cheated. He used some wind tunnel tests at Wright Patton to prove his design. So he kept modifying it to get it down to look like the UFOs he'd been investigating. So he knew it was a flyable thing because he actually saw these UFOs. He visited so many people who investigated them who had sightings of them. And so he thought to himself, if someone else can do it, he can do it too. And then his research of the slides that you have is going back from, I think, 1898. The different countries like Russia, England, Sweden, their parabolic gliders, also parachutes, proving that such a design was practical. And he talked about the flying wing. But he said there's some instability with the flying wing, which I think the Horton brothers of Germany did. And then the Air Force finally came out with, I think they built two of them, and I saw some pictures in some Air Force magazine, and they were very unstable. But they did build two of them, and they flew them, I think, in the early 50s. But he said there were certain inherent design problems, and he said it would never work because it was just a flying wing.
Did your father ever discuss with you his low aspect ratio aircraft design?
Oh, yeah, many times he would talk about dihedrals and the angles and the low aspect. And later on in life, he got into stalls, short takeoff and landings, that type of aircraft. But he built these model airplanes and then flew them with both his rocket motors and then gasoline powered. I've seen him fly his. Like they said in the newspaper, the flying pumpkin. Mm-hmm. And he would fly them, hand glide them first, and some of those would wobble. But his concept was showing that with the right power plant, he said the whole secret was having enough power plant. And he was only using either a puller or a pusher. The rocket engines were in the back. And that would be the pusher and the puller when he had the gasoline engines up in front of his flying ellipsoid, I'd call them, his parabolic design aircraft.
Still kind of very saucer kind of shape.
Yeah. I mean, he proved that the shape was right, and then he said in his patent, he says that with various slots, we could direct the flow of the engine, whether down to the sides or up. And he says this way you could make 90-degree turns without any slippage. And there's times when he and I would be out at night and we saw what he said were UFOs, these red lights up in the sky, and they would make these 90-degree turns. He says, see, that's what they can do without any slippage. And then the Harrier jets, the next time I thought about it, when I saw those in Atlanta at air shows in the late 1980s, the British Harrier jets were using somewhat the same concept, by directing the flow of the jet engines, and that's where they could hover and then take off. But they were a very primitive concern compared to what my dad had in mind back in 1948. The Harrier jets were an improvement on helicopters and current aircraft, but they still didn't have all the attributes that Heath's patent showed.
Did the Air Force, at any time, to your knowledge, show any interest in your father's low aspect ratio aircraft? Did they want it?
I don't know of any of that. They did accept some of his designs, like putting the little winglets on the refueling booms, because they're having a lot of fighter crashes when they try to refuel them. So he designed this little wings, put at the end of the boom to stabilize it, to give it flying characteristics, so it wouldn't whip around. And so he got apparently $250 for that design. I remember that patent. More as an award. Because all this work he did under government's time, he couldn't have his own patents. And so I don't know how he got some of these patents in his name, but the biggest one is UFO model, is flying pumpkin seed, or is ellipsoid, flying ellipsoid, or he did on his own, apparently.
Were you with your dad when he tried out the flying saucer type model?
Oh, yes.
Did you go to the wind tunnel test?
No, I couldn't. I never went to the flight path.
He snuck in and did that after hours?
Yeah.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, he's had enough friends. I mean, I think he did some at Langley with his stalls. He was modifying his own aircraft at the time. And he flew them as gliders first without power planes. And then he modified it, kept modifying the knowledge. So he got it down the way the patent was supposed to be. And the big secret is power plants, and he said they have UFOs that he knew about. They had a tremendous power, and they could do this. And they had he said they used some type of magnetic field, because when the UFOs got close to vehicles or radio transmitters, they cut off the car engines. And you know, so the writings that you've seen, people mention that too now.
And would your father, when from talking to people who had a UFO sighting and that, would he talk to you about it?
Yeah, he would confer to me, and not too much of my brother. I don't remember my brother being around some of these family meetings like that, or my father and I. And he would confer to me, and I don't know how much to his mother, to his wife, she was not too concerned about all the technical aspects. But I happened to be an eager ear, and so I would be someone he could talk to or through, whether I was there or not. He was just talking anyway. And he had someone he wanted to try out a theory, and he would use me as a bouncing board, just as someone to talk to, not that I could come back with any input when I was 13 or 14 years old.
Did your father ever explain to you that some of the things and some of the work that he was doing was classified?
Yeah,
and specifically, did he ever tell you that what I'm telling you, you're not to tell anyone?
I think he said many times it was classified work, and he was working on his UFO investigation. He did a lot of travel. He did mention Dr. Goddard's name. And then, of course, after the war, they bring in German scientist Walter von Braun. He said he wasn't that much of a good rocket scientist, but he was a good administrator. And he says a better brains like Dr. Walter Lippisch. And he said von Braun wasn't a great aeronautical man, but he was a good administrator. And he says there are needs for people like that, too.
Let's talk about Lippisch for a moment. You said that Dr. Lippisch would come over to the house. Could you tell me about that?
Well, I remember that's just the one time it was a big thing to have a... an enemy crowd come over to the house. Dad had mentioned about interviewing these rocket scientists, and he thought very highly of them. And there was a group of them, I forget how many, whether 12 or so, that they brought to Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. And that was a big dinner. I don't remember much about it, just that Dr. Walter Lippisch was at the house, and it was very pleasant. And of course, like most non-Americans, everybody can speak more than one language, so this man was versed in German. Of course, English is very good, too, at the time.
So your father spoke a lot of German in the house?
No, there's no German spoken, but the Dr. Lippisch was bilingual, and most people you meet in other countries know more than one language. Americans only know one language, and that's badly, that's English.
Very true. Yeah. Very true. I have tried to learn French, Spanish. I just have no knack to pick up another language.
I learned Spanish by accident when Texaco sent me to Central America. I had to learn Spanish.
Real quick, huh?
Well, if you were in the bar drinking and you want to go to bath, and you got to do something. That's a story.
Did Lippisch ever talk to you personally? I mean,
That was just the one time I remember in dinner, and I was just in awe about having a foreigner sitting in a house. And
at the time, under Project Paperclip, when they were bringing engineers, German engineers and scientists back to the United States, there was a prisoner of war camp in Dayton at the time. Obviously, not all of these scientists or engineers were there. Most of them ended up in New Mexico, at the White Sands, Alamogordo area, and that a few of them stayed on at Wright-Patterson. Did you and your father ever visit the German POW camp there in Dayton?
No, I never knew there was a POW camp. I just assumed they all had their housing arranged for them. They were never, it was never discussed, or I recall that they were prisoners of war. They just repatriated, or whatever you want to call it.
Did your dad ever talk to Marion, his wife, about UFOs? And what did your mother think about it? And about your father?
I don't remember any input. They never did seem to discuss it. Dad always used me as his confidant. It was never seemed to be discussed at the dinner tables. It was always when he and I were by ourselves, which was usually in the basement or outside when I was working on his car or something like that. So it was not a family discussion.
Was there any UFO case that your dad went to investigate that he was very, very excited about that he told you about? We're always interested in certain things and this and that, but every once in a while there's something that really jumps out and a person really gets super excited.
I'd say about every trip he came back, he was excited about every sighting he saw. And he really believed that the UFOs were real. He went into a lot of investigations, and they were phony things. Someone used a pie dish and made a bad photograph of it. And so, you know, 80% of the investigations were those. And people asked me about the little green man at Wright-Patterson Air Force Base, but we had a funeral basement. My dad's drinking buddies. But I think with Dad's nature that he was very serious and very truthful. And he confided in me all the sightings he saw in his visit to Alamogordo and New Mexico and Dr. Goddard and Walter von Braun and all these people I met. And he never hid anything from me. Now, he never wanted to bring home paperwork. I never saw any classified documents. I never saw any work yet, other than his own engineering drawings. So in those days, it's different than the industrial espionage done today. I think all those people were very security-minded, and they did not bring papers home. So that's why I don't think you'd find any documents lying around.
Did your dad ever mention to you a report that supposedly was done by the Project Sign team, of which he was the civilian head of, called the Estimate of the Situation?
No, I didn't find out about that till later, but he did make a comment that he sent a report to Washington, and later I found that this was called the Estimate. But he talked about that it was his report, and later we find there's no signatures. It's always these other people who were signing things for him, which has always irritated him. But he did make the report, and he said it went up to Washington. I think it was, I'm going to say it's probably May or June of the time of year, it could have been 48, 49. And he was very upset that Washington shut it down and made no comment about it.
So that I'm real clear on this now, your father told you about a report that he made,
yes,
and sent,
yes,
to the Pentagon. Did he mention any names on who he sent it to?
No, and it was, he just said it was hushed up.
Okay, but he didn't give you a title of,
no,
this document.
No.
But later on, when you first heard about the Estimate of the Situation, then you kind of put two and two together.
Yes, that was probably the same thing.
Was your dad's report.
Yeah, he put the report. But going back, you asked me the other question about his investigation, UFOs. He would go to one site, and it would, where something had been landed and it was blackened grass and had high sulfur smells. And he had wanted to, several occasions where he investigated sites like that. And he told me one time he thought the aliens or the UFO occupants could actually be insects. I don't know.
Did he give you a reason?
No, I was going to say because
I might have thought that. Because in ufology, there have been others who think that UFOs might even be animals living in the atmosphere.
Well, that's what I was alluding to, I think, that when he found these burnt areas with high sulfur smell, he thought it could have been like the old dragons over here in mythology. There was something that was animal-like, or the insect-like, because he knew the pressures they had to do withstand in these vessels they traveled in. But if you look at some of the old UFO movies, and they always have these little creatures in these helmets, and if anything looks different than you and me, we think it's weird. And of course, I'm sure this creature's looking at us thinking we're weird. But there's, he definitely believed that the UFOs exist and were real. He definitely believed there was something that maneuvered them, and it was real, whether man-like or insect-like. But if it looked a little bit different, to withstand the pressures of space, they could look assumed to be like insects.
With a hard shell or whatever.
With a hard shell, and they would look different on us.
Makes a lot of sense.
And but he never mentioned anything about abductions of people, any of his investigations. These were sightings where state police officers, Air Force pilots who investigate commercial airline pilots, and he knew that they were telling the truth of their sightings.
Was there ever a time that your dad told you about going to Newfoundland to investigate a sighting?
Well, he mentioned he went to a lot of different places, but I don't remember Newfoundland as a point. But he did say he was amazed how the electric motors, or I mean the car motors, were stopped. And these anti-magnetic
fields.
Well,
what did he say about that, other than it was just anti-magnetic?
We felt there was a strong magnetic force that were driving these UFO vehicles, and had to do with magnetism and anti-magnetic fields. And to fly all these distances, I always felt that you had to change matter to go the distances through space. My dad thought they had to be very strong power plants in these vehicles to make them perform as they did. And typically, he always used the deal of making a 90-degree turn without any slippage.
Do you remember your father ever talking to the press or the media or seeing photographers at the house or anything?
No. The only ones I saw were those newspaper clippings where they interviewed him in Richmond, Virginia, I think.
Mike Hall, my associate, ran across a newspaper article dealing with your mother and your father back in 1932.
Huh.
They saw an unidentified flying object. Did your parents ever talk to you about that?
No.
No? Okay. I'd like to read it to you, if I could. It's kind of abbreviated, but almost all of it's there. In October 1932, the couple, your mother and father, saw such an object one evening while driving near Plainsboro, New Jersey, he reported. At first, they thought an aircraft was crashing nearby. Then the craft leveled off, flashed away at high speed, emitting a changing bluish-green light. On returning to his home, he immediately sketched the object from memory. Later, he said former New York Congressman L.G. Clemente reported he had seen an object at about the same time. Loading estimated the object he and his wife had seen was about 100 feet in diameter and 500 to 600 feet high up in the air. He said the object gave off a weird light, like looking at a firefly, that appeared to change shape. He said he had seen nothing of a similar nature since. And your father or your mother never talked about that?
I never remember at all my mother saying anything about UFOs or David or talking to her in my presence.
Do you think he might have?
Yeah, I guess so. I don't see why. You know, why he wouldn't. So that he saw many of the sightings and interviewed people, and most of it was secondhand, although he and I had looked at some back in the skies at night. But he was intensely interested in all the interviews he went on, especially the ones that were authentic. And he really believed...
Did he ever explain to you how, when he came back from investigating some of the cases. How he arrived at whether he thought that it could have been a joke or a hoax, or why he thought certain ones were authentic?
Well, because the people he talked with, the credibility of them, and being the scientist that he was, he could see through the hoaxes that he'd say, well, these are just a phony photograph, it was a saucer pan someone threw up in the air. And the people he talked with had a lot of credibility, the State Patrol people, the airline people, the aviation, Air Force people he talked with, that they had no reason to give him false information.
To your knowledge, did your father ever investigate a case that, where a UFO was observed by a military personnel?
Yeah, yes, yes.
What did he say about that one? Do you remember when this was?
Well, this is a... most of the times when he came back, he had talked to Air Force or Army people, or State Patrol, or at least the qualified people, or airline, commercial airline pilots. So he talked to those people, and he knew that what they saw were real, and all the sightings seemed to fit together. They all had similar circumstances, and they fit the odds of cars stopping and so forth, and flashing blue lights, and how they could move so fast and get away or hover near an aircraft and disappear very fast.
Did your father ever cue if the Air Force or the Army or whatever had ever recovered one of these objects?
No, he never mentioned that. And I think if there was something like that, he would have told me, because he was treated in confidence everything else he saw. And his viewpoints. And if there were any crashes or green people, he would have mentioned them. Because everything he was doing was under secret clearance at that time. All the investigations, as you know, the whole project. So he was very... And something like that, he would have really... He wouldn't be able to hold it in. He would have to tell me about something like that.
He would have to tell you?
Yeah.
He wouldn't be able to keep something like that in.
Because he told me about all these other sightings. And the most remarkable ones were the sulfur fumes, the burnt areas. He couldn't explain that.
Other than he thought that the occupants might be insect-like.
Well, that's what he thought. It was a high hydrogen sulfide fumes. That's what it related. It could be insect or animal. But he said normally if a flying machine like that, the propulsion would land in place naturally with burning grass.
I want to get back a little bit back to Wright Field or Wright-Patterson after the Army Air Corps switched over and became a separate body known as the United States Air Force. Then switched all the bases, switched over to Air Force Base.
Mm-hmm.
So it became Wright-Patterson Air Force Base. Are there any recollections at all that you have of ever going onto the base or visiting your dad's office? Or?
No, I never made it to his office, and I don't recall being on the base. I've been by it, but I've never been on it. I never saw his office. I got the impression he was happier to be away from the fight pack than go on it. Spare time. And I think he looked very forward to being home on his own and doing his own little work projects.
He liked to try. He liked to do the traveling, though, did he not?
Yeah.
You stated that you had never heard the term Project Sign mentioned before, that you had always known it as Project Blue Book.
Yes. Matter of fact, my file I keep has Project Blue Book written on it, which I've been keeping for a few years.
Did your father ever mention a project called Grudge?
No. Those are all the new names I found out in the last year or two.
Okay.
Sign Grudge.
So I've taken it then that when your father talked to you about some of the things that he did, where he went to, he really never gave you names, but just what went on and
yes.
Some of the exciting things about
mm-hmm.
it. Okay.
He mentioned the only name was the officers in charge that he had to work through with some colonels.
Did he ever mention a Captain Robert Schneider?
No, I don't recall that.
Miles Gall?
No. It was interesting that Hoyt Vandenberg, who was the commander general of the thing, sent the estimate up, his final report. He called it his final report.
Now let me stop you for a second real quick. Because I really want to make sure I got this. Your father, by himself, wrote the report?
Yes.
Okay.
That's what he told me. It was his report.
The reason that's important is that sheds an awful lot of new light on things. Because we've always assumed that the report itself was the whole science team writing the report. And this might not necessarily be so. So this is something you really have to start looking into.
See, my dad always told me it was his project, and he was directing this project. And that memo in July 1947 showed that he was called in to start the investigation.
Right, with Dr. Charles Carroll.
And then the rest of the time he said it was his project, his report. And once he got back to Wright Patt in 1955, he never again mentioned UFOs.
Do you know why?
He was very upset in 51. I think that was when the report went, 50-51. And then he got, you see the personnel reports, and they started getting them bad ratings. And then he made a moral deal about getting his rating upgraded. And then he got eased out, just like the old corporations, you know, when they want somebody out. So they eased him out, and that's when he got into the chemical company. But he came back to Wright Patt 1 year after General Vandenberg died. Vandenberg died in 54, Dad came back to Wright Patt in 55. Very interesting.
Did he ever tell you why?
No.
He went back? Did he become a little more secretive at that point?
No, and then went with Langley, and of course I think Michael Loading thought maybe he was assigned to Langley near Williamsburg, Virginia, to help train the astronauts and learning what to do if they ran into UFOs. But it was never discussed when he was at Langley. He never mentioned his work. But it's also what the astronauts were training at that time. But he never again mentioned UFOs when he was down in Kansas He was so dedicated to it, you know, in the early days, from 47 to 50.
And then just all of a sudden?
It stopped.
Did you ever ask him?
No. He didn't want to discuss it, and he was so heartbroken that his report to Washington got squelched and got hushed up. He did mention that several times.
When you say that he felt heartbroken, that did he ever go into detail?
No.
On that caused him such grief?
Well, knowing all the stories he told me about all his trips, this is a major project to him. He believed there was something there, it was real. It was an aeronautical breakthrough. From the pure professionalism, he thought that was better than sliced bread. And they're on the frontier of new aerodynamics, propulsion systems, and the whole ball of wax. And all of a sudden it was put down.
Okay, so immediately after he sent his report and Vandenberg shot it down, did that also affect your father's attitude as far as designing aircraft again? Did he stop designing aircraft and go off and do other things at that point?
I guess so, looking back, you're probably right, because I never knew he got laid off and fired from Wright Patt. And, you know, the personnel record don't show it. It shows indications. All of a sudden, his ratings started going down. And I've seen this in the corporate life. And they started putting pressure on him. So one way or another, he got out. And but when we moved to New Jersey, I never saw him do that much more work on the drawing board because he was doing more house projects out in the yard and things like that.
So he just really kind of seemed to you to have lost interest.
Yeah, and then at that time he took up flying, was 50, and then when he died in Winsburg, he had his own airplane there and he brought it into the garage. And he was taking the wings off and making stall, you know, short takeoff and landing, and trying to modify his aircraft. He spent more time on that than actual design or drafting type of work. He spent his last few years more on short takeoff and landing aircraft and doing his own flying.
Do you recall if your father ever received any kind of special attention during the war years from scientists or high-ranking military people? Did he mention any time that, gosh, you know, I've been selected to do this or I've been selected to do that, or they've really enjoyed my work, or whatever? And I'm not talking about after 1948, I'm talking about up to 1947.
No, I don't. Those days aren't too clear with me, except I know he did some traveling during the war.
And what did he do? Did he ever tell you?
No, I just done military trips. He flew in military aircraft.
I brought you information on the hydro bomb, because your father mentioned that he worked on the hydro bomb. And did he ever talk to you openly about his work on the hydro bomb?
No, it wasn't until I saw some information about that a couple of years ago, and that the information I saw never did explain what the hydro bomb was, so I never mentioned that. He never mentioned anything about, and of course he started up the Jet Propulsion Laboratory too, which I didn't know about. He originated that. But he only talked about the UFO project primarily, and on his work. Any other work was his model aircrafts, airplane building, and his models.
Your dad obviously have like 120 slides that he used. What kind of lectures did he give, and who did he give these lectures and talks to?
I didn't really know those until I got them from my mother, I think. And then I had them in storage for 30 years until dug them out of the storage I had in here, and that's the first time I looked at them in years.
Did your dad ever say what groups and that he actually talked to, or?
No. Back in those days, he mentioned, you know, Dr. Goddard and Walter von Braun, and I in a slideshow, a picture of him, Goddard Air Force Base. But he never mentioned the slides. I didn't know they existed until I got them after he died. And I didn't realize all the patents he had made either. But he kept, I know he had the patent attorney who was always running back and forth with him too.
I want to ask you about this flying saucer model again.
There are two models we carried with us for several years, and both got broken up, I think, in the last move. The one with the, it was a red. One of the first rocket models, red wings with a regular conventional body, and then the UFO type of model.
How big was it actually?
Oh, I guess it was probably about 2 feet diameter, you know, ellipsoid type of thing.
And from the photograph, all we have is black and white. Did he paint it in any specific color? Or?
Yeah, there's some color. Maybe it had some reds in it, and then there was also wood with fabric, you know, regular also type of aircraft.
In other words, he would make the internal structure out of balsa wood.
Right, and framing and all, and
covered with fabric.
Tissue, yeah. Tissue.
Did he show the engines in that?
No, he had rocket mounts in the back, and the other models where you'd see the passengers, he'd have a gasoline powered motor up in there. They flew regular model airplanes.
Was the model itself, did he have it so that he could separate it so that you could look inside of it?
No, just the front where you cover up the engine, the gasoline engine. But the rest of it was just it's all fabricated. There isn't that. Well, it's three-dimensional, but there wasn't. You couldn't take it apart.
Oh, okay.
And it was David when it's
some models people build.
Yeah.
Yeah, they can take apart and say, well, here are the seating arrangements, mm-hmm. and the power plant.
Well, he couldn't operate the slots that he wanted to direct the power, you know, according to this patent. So the plane wobbled a little bit unless it went fast enough, then it was stable in flight. But you could imagine that if he could have a sufficient power plant that he talked about, that he could, the aircraft could do all things he talked about. Because it was, being an ellipsoid, it had like a leading edge around the whole circumference. So that's why you'd go any direction and it'd be like a flying wing.
All right, so we know that your father kind of went on base after hours to check out his design.
Well, whether it's after hours or during the time to meet some friends,
whatever.
Yeah.
But he used the facilities at Wright-Patterson to the wind tunnel and that mm-hmm. to check out his design. I think that's really neat. Did this model actually fly? I mean, did he put actual small solid propellant rockets or engines or gasoline engines or anything to actually see if it would actually fly?
Oh, yeah, that's what they said. He actually flew them, and I saw them fly, both with the rocket motors and the gasoline
engines.
And
they just wobbled just a little bit?
Yeah, wobbled a little bit, but then it would fly and take off and then and land in after the gasoline engine, the fuel were expended, or the rocket motors were expended.
Do you remember how the gasoline engines actually work? I mean, was it kind of a thrust, or was it a propeller inside?
Well, it's just a propeller hit it near the front where the passenger and his joint, the passenger would be, get the motor sitting there, propeller up front. So it operated just like any other model airplane.
Okay. Now, the pumpkin seed, was that the actual toy
that
he developed?
The pumpkin seed, what the press called it, I think that's a Richmond, Virginia, one press report, they call it the flying pumpkin seed. But that was the actual flying model.
Okay.
All the models he made, either they flew or he broke them up and built another one. If it didn't fly, he didn't show it around. Because everybody wanted to say, well, can you sail it? Take it up and sail it through the air.
So the model of the flying saucer looking prep, see,
yeah.
Whatever, was that, did he design that for just for it to be a toy, or did he design that to maybe show his superiors?
Well, he thought it could be a production type aircraft. He wanted to prove the feasibility that it was viable and aeronautical and sound. That's why he made that intensive patent. If you go through it and read that, there's a lot of technical jargon in that. But from that, he proved the patent by actually flying the model, both as without power and with power.
But he also...
He thought
it would also make a good toy?
No, he never thought of it as a toy. It was just a engineering aeronautical breakthrough. And he thought of it being the answer to a family aircraft. He talked about that down the road. This would be a family way to put... And some of his drawings show three or four people, family people, sitting in the front. I think
to replace cars.
That would be a light aircraft that everybody could use, because you wouldn't have the problems of airfields. You could land it in your backyard. That's what I said, because of the propulsion plant and the way you don't need a long takeoffs or runways or anything else. It would be a hovercraft. Be very useful as that's a family vehicle. So that's what he envisioned it as. So he's trying to put something that he investigated under Project Blue Book, the Project Sign, as UFOs, to make a practical application. And this is an aeronautical breakthrough.
Based upon his forward-thinking designs prior or during the war or prior to the war.
Which he stole from UFOs.
And then when the UFO phenomenon, the flying discs started being observed in 1940, end of 46, beginning of 47. Then he thought, wow,
Yeah, well, I'll probably get sued for one of the UFOs now because of the gas color designs. They see a discrimination suit or something. Or green people have me in court. But no, he was able to assemble data, but, you know, he went back as far as Nostradamus and the sightings of UFOs. That's back 1,000 years.
Did your dad actually do a lot of reading, too, and a lot of research?
Yeah, apparently he did research back in Nostradamus. I forget what era that was. That must have been 1,000 years ago.
And he followed 1452.
Yeah, I think just shortly after I was born. But, he did a lot of research that way.
Shortly after you were born. I'm sorry, I'm sitting here doing an interview. It went right over my head. Mike, you need to be here. This is great.
But he was, he did all that research, you know, that was something there, and I chided Mike. Well, why cover just 100 years of UFO sighting? It's been going on for centuries. And that's what people forget. And even over in Peru, all those carvings and the rocks, they thought they could only be done by geophotos, gouging out the rocks. And some of the sketches they show look like people like astronauts.
Yeah.
Or the Incas.
Did your dad, after 1950, did you ever see your dad read any books that were coming out around that time on UFOs?
No. I don't remember ever seeing a book on UFOs in those days. And I never did see Dad, you know, pick up a book like I'm trying to read here, Redstone Rising. He was not a bookworm. Anything he read, I had to be a technical journal or something. And he just kind of, it was like a scientific sponge. He just assimilated information into him. And he talked to people, and you can see that he was turning their brains inside out. He wouldn't ask a question unless he wondered the right answer. And he just assimilated information from everybody he talked to. And so when he talked to these German scientists and Dr. Goddard and anybody else, he was just bringing it all in like a sponge and trying to put it into his own perspective and come up with something practical. He was not going into theoretical stuff as much as what's the practical use of it. So he would not build the pumpkin seed or UFO model to be a toy for kids. He wanted something that could prove it could fly and had practical application. And all of his inventions apparently were that way, just like the winglets for the retrieving animal. And of course his brother Herb was an engineer. He designed the first thing that helped the spaceships
on the Gantry.
The Gantry, yeah. He designed that thing. And he had his own engineering firm, and then his business went down the tube.
Did your dad ever help?
No, they were doing two separate areas. When they get together, they would talk shop once in a while, you know, on their summer vacations. But Herb was very intense, too. And,
do you know if Herb believed in UFOs?
I don't know what he talked to his brothers about. But Herb was more practical. I guess Freddie was a go-between in the thought of Uncle Buddy Charles, though, and as the youngest. So I don't know how much they had confided to Charles, but I'm sure Fred would have some good input. His other brother, John, but he's older now. He's had some health problems. I think both between Fred and Charles, both of them wanted to give some input. Dad would tell them. So, at the family reunions, you know, nothing was. They had these newspaper clippings and all on the tables, you know, for each of the brothers in the background. And of course, Dad was about to smile. I can see UFOs were. But not much was ever mentioned in the family reunions. More about that. And his brothers, never confided in anything about too much of UFOs.
I have just a couple more questions.
Sure.
What was it about your dad that just you admired absolutely the most?
I guess his dedication to his work, but I guess more to his ideals that he had set for himself. He wanted to be a perfectionist in aviation. And it's unfortunately he waited to the age of 50 before he started to fly, because then he could really feel an assimilation of all his work. He was not a very fluid, non-technical type of aircraft, like the Lockheed Champ and the Piper J5. The PA-17, which he had me flying, and it flew like a damn brick. And I was flying these floppy J3s, the big wingspans, and he had this PA-17, which was a very short coupled airplane, short fuselage, short wings. So when you cut the power, it just glided like a brick. And when you took off or landed, you had to walk the pedals because it wanted to rotate on you. It was very difficult airplane to get up in the air. But he wanted me to solo it, and I made three landings, and I got out of it, and so I ain't going to go back up. Because I bounced all over the place. That worked for his ideal he had. He wanted to be perfectionist in aeronautical science and do as much good he could for the advancement of that science. So all his work, he went 110% into it to prove ideas, prove hypotheses, and do that type of achievement. And that was his goal in life, his ideal. Putting everything else aside, his dedication to his ideal and his work was his major goal. Fame was secondary. Friends were secondary. He had a few friends. But his real love was working hard and working to prove something.
And that's what you admire.
Yeah. And as a man, you couldn't buy him off an idea. And that's what he got in his problems with his superiors all the time, because he said, this is right. And that the old German, we have our orders, and damn the torpedoes, he was going to prove his point. And he was so sure what he did, and he was, looking back, he was never wrong. And anything he said, he did.
Do you think that this might have been one of the reasons that later on in the 50s that his evaluations might have started to go down? Because obviously his evaluations, and we have them, of course, were excellent, above excellent.
Well, he had that one man.
And then there was that slide.
48, I think it was named Rogers, reevaluated for him and got him back up to a good rating. But I think he had the personality conflicts there, and I've got the views that people up in Washington still put the pressure on him and got him out. Because it was all of a sudden, he was a fair-haired boy for years there, and all of a sudden, once the estimate of the situation, his report went to Washington, is when they put the kibosh on him. And he was a broken man.
And you actually witnessed this directly.
Yeah.
Saw the deterioration.
Yeah. And then we went to Unixel Chemical Company, and I worked there in the summer job when I was at Ohio State, and they moved to Hightstown, New Jersey, and then to Princeton. And there was nothing but a munitions factory. They made 500-pound napalm bombs there. And I worked in the yards putting together stands for it, oak planking, 500-pound bombs. And he was the director of jet propulsion, but he didn't see anything. They made fireworks and they made napalm bombs. And I think the company probably hired him there and gave him a good pay to influence in Washington trying to get some contracts for government contracts. But I never saw any. There's no jet engines or anything else there, although he was the director of jet propulsion. He had a very kind of very small office there. Typical little factory munitions, hard crack.
And then when your father went back to write letters, did that surprise your mother also?
I don't remember getting the vibes from then. They went back to Ohio. Of course, I guess a few friends there. And I'm sure he took quite a cut in pay. But I don't know what happened to Unixel, whether the company went bankrupt. I think they had some financial problems. And so he kind of crept back into Wright-Patt for security. And he always talked glowingly of being a civil servant, working for the government. He says it added stability and security. And he was always looking to be retired when he was 65. That was his whole goal, too, to be retired.
Talking about that, did he ever interview you after retirement, what he wanted to do? What his goals and dreams might have been after?
No.
Never sure that.
No, in those later years before he died, he really got a kick out of flying his own airplane and actually doing aviation stuff in the air, hands-on. So, but he always liked the security of... he never showed any bitterness going back, but he was very thankful he got a job back. And then was, I don't know how it worked out, but he got transferred to Langley and they moved to Reed. He liked Williamsburg, and he liked his work at NASA. He was a liaison, U.S. Air Force liaison officer with NASA. And he had a very good boss there. That's kind of like a French name, but he can't think of it at all. But he was very happy there, because I remember dying of cancer at the time. But it was... It was interesting how he seemed to get back to the right path right after his nemesis passed away, Vanderbilt and Hitchcock. But being a son and child, they didn't talk much about transitions.
Let me interrupt you for a second. When you say his nemesis, Vandenberg, did he ever talk about Vandenberg, out loud?
No, he just, that was the Washington, the people, and later I found out who the Washington people were. The last few years. But he never mentioned that name. He just said Washington.
And he always kind of disliked Washington.
Yeah, well, because that's the only time he mentioned badly about him, because about his report.
Did he ever mention a Dr. Charles Carroll?
No, I don't recall that name. Yeah, he could have, but you know, it's been so many years ago. I just, you know, the major military men I remember was Major Sweet. Took me out to have a flying machine. But I know this.
A lot of fun.
Yeah.
When I was in Civil Air Patrol, spot stories here. When I was in Civil Air Patrol, a pilot came in to our local air show. And he was in a bi-wing aircraft, open cockpit. I said, "Hey, you want to go out?" I said, "Sure." I've been used to flying, but never did I ever get back on the ground and my legs were wobbling around, and I must have walked across that flight line like a bowl full of jelly. I was just looking. This guy did loops and barrel rolls to the ground. So I can imagine, what was going on with the glider.
Yeah, those biplanes give you a trip.
Oh, all the wind brushing your face. The noise was deafening.
Matter of fact, I got my oldest son, we're in Costa Rica. I got him a flight in a steerman biplane. And fortunately, there wasn't enough time for me to go up, because I didn't want to go up in the steerman, but my son did, and he really enjoyed his flight. But, going back to Einstein in Princeton, when my folks lived there, I almost ran over Einstein. He was coming out of the liquor store. He walked between two parked cars, had a bottle of whiskey in a paper bag. He stepped right in front of my car. That was a Sterling College at Ohio State. And he just slammed on the brakes. He was right in the hood of my car and just looked at me. And I said, "Oh my God, I almost killed Einstein."
Did your dad know Albert Einstein?
No, I don't know if he did or not. But he was there in Princeton. That's when my dad was still at Lenox Chemical Company. But he was... MC Squared almost got squashed with his liquor bottle in his hands.
I claimed the fame.
What a footnote to history. Mike's just gonna love this.
I'm gonna have to. I'm gonna get to a good physicist or a good library and find out his theory of unified particles. I read briefly about it, but I think he was on the threshold of how we can. Go to speed. It's like Jonathan Livingston Seagull said, speed is being there. You have to think about that. That's what space travel is all about.
Someone
has to go faster than the speed of light.
Well, obviously you've read about this, so let me ask you this question. If you're in a car that can go the speed of light, what happens when you turn the headlights on?
It's dark.
Don, God bless you and thank you very, very much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
Very much. Your father was a remarkable man.
He was.